This episode of Crossing the 180 is brought to you by Sony's C Media Cloud. C supports the entire media lifecycle to streamline workflows for your video production teams so that you can go from camera to cloud to Final Cut faster. Learn more about C and book your free demo at sonymcs.com. That's Sony, M as in Mary, C as in Charlie, S as in Sam.com.
Good morning, Vietnam! Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up!
You talking to me?
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Hi-de-ho, all you girls, boys, and non-binaries out there. This is your boy, Ron Dawson, coming at you with another edition of your favorite filmmaking podcast that breaks all the rules, Crossing the 180, part of the Art of the Frame podcast network by Film Tools and Pro Video Coalition. Every other week, I have engaging and informative conversations about culture and craft with artists, entrepreneurs, and filmmakers doing amazing work in the worlds of film and television. And today is a first. I have a story producer, and I've never had a story producer before. This is Marissa Messiano, and she just recently wrapped on a pilot for a documentary series that's going to be on Vice. And as of this recording, she wasn't able to give us details about what it was, but we were able to get into details about the work she does and how she does it. What does it mean to be a story producer? If that's something you're interested in, how does a story producer differentiate themselves from an associate producer or the other aspects that you might find on a television show, and how for TV shows like reality TV shows and documentaries, a story producer's work comes into play, including the work that she did on Dancing with the Stars, which I found, you know, pretty interesting. And, you know, as usual, I always like to start with some kind of story related to the person. And she has a fun Sound of Music story that I think you'll find interesting. So I think you're going to find this an interesting conversation, particularly if this is something that you want to get into. Let's get into it. Here's my interview with Marissa Messiano, who is a story producer extraordinaire. See you on the other side. Well, so the question that I usually like to start with is, what was your first movie memory in terms of the earliest memory you have of a movie going experience or a movie watching experience that had any kind of impact on you that's memorable?
I'd probably have to go with The Sound of Music.
Oh, okay. I'm already a fan. Why is that?
Two VHS tapes that I burned through to the point where you could not watch them clearly anymore were the animated Jungle Book.
Uh-huh.
I love the music.
Right.
And The Sound of Music. Mm-hmm. So I was definitely into movie musicals from an early age. I would, you know, like any four-year-old does, pretend you're part of the Von Trapp family and do the choreography and sing around the living room with the songs and the kids. So I don't know if you're familiar with The Sound of Music on VHS. It's really two VHS tapes.
Two VHS tapes, yeah.
And I only knew that the first one existed.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently I'm not the only kid to have been manipulated into this. Like, I didn't know the second tape existed. All I knew is that after the kids went to bed, like, all right, movie's over. Like, there were no Nazis. There was no weapons. There was no hiding. There was no refugee experience. It was kids get a new nanny and they get to sing and dance and they go to a party and that's the movie. And when I was older, it was on television one night. I was probably 10, 11. And I yelled up the stairs to my mom. I was like, they made a Sound of Music too. Like, how did we miss this?
Right.
And she had to explain to me that there was really a whole second half to the movie that I just had never been allowed to watch.
That is amazing. Have you heard I think it's This American Life. It's either This American Life or one of those NPR style podcasts. They did a story about just this. The person they interviewed for the story, she grew up loving and watching The Sound of Music. And at some point when she was an adult, someone asked her, well, what do you think about like the Nazis or whatever? She's like, what Nazis? And she learned as an adult that there's this part two. Because, like, just like you said, like, it was so funny. As you were telling the story, I was wondering, were you the person that was on This American Life? Because it was the same thing. Because up until that intermission part, that first half, it's the party and everything's, you know, so long, farewell. And it's like this kind of bittersweet ending where she's not going to be with the captain and she decides to leave. And then, right, and then part two is Nazis. And yeah, so that's, I think that's fascinating that this whole group, this whole generation of people who grew up loving The Sound of Music but not knowing there was this entire second half.
Exactly.
So when you watched that second half, like, what impact did it have on you?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I don't quite remember like watching that story for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say it was probably like in small pieces, because I do remember like the Uncle Max scenes. I don't know how familiar you are with The Sound of Music,
yeah,
but I do remember
I love it.
Some
of
those scenes from that second tape, watching those as a kid. So maybe there were parts where I got to watch some of it, or I saw some of it on TV, but it's kind of blurry. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I knew that they escaped in the end. Like, once you
right.
watch it for the 10th, 12th, 15th time, like,
right.
you know, it's going to be okay. And what happens exactly. But I definitely didn't understand the depth of and the gravity of the situation of what was happening and how threatened they were. And I definitely skipped over boring moments and moments I didn't care about as a kid. I was like, where are the kids? Get me back to the kids. I don't care about this boring adult storyline. Yeah.
Yeah. So my funny introduction to it. So I first saw it when it was actually, this was way probably before your time, but before there was HBO, there was this thing in that area called the Z Channel, which was the channel for watching movies. And my mom was watching it. And the first time I watched it was the scene where they're having the picnic and she's about to teach them how to sing, whatever. And at the time I was a kid, I was a huge fan of Lost in Space. And I had a huge crush on Penny, played by Angela Cartwright, who's in The Sound of Music. And so the first thing I noticed was the girl that I had a crush on from Lost in Space is in The Sound of Music. And so that's what first, like, inured me to. It was like, oh, I have to watch this movie. Penny's in it. But then, you know, I just love the music and everything. And I always remember being frustrated in the second half where, like, the captain and, you know, the Nazi boyfriend of Liesl is going to turn them in. But then the captain talks him out of it. And he's just about to convince them to go. And he's like, you'll never be one of them. And it's like, I remember as a kid thinking, why the hell did you say that? I mean, I don't know if I thought hell, but I was like, why did you say that? You had him. And then you just had to do that. So
exactly.
That's funny.
Now, Rolf isn't the greatest person, but I also loved that the nuns, I understood that the nuns cut the wires.
The cars.
I remember my mom explaining that to me, like, they, you know, they did something they shouldn't have because they were really doing what was right. And, you know, and having that conversation. And I always loved that moment.
Yeah, definitely. So what was it for you that kind of got you interested in telling story, video production, filmmaking? Was there something in particular? What was it that kind of brought you to that?
I've always been, you know, obsessed with television.
Mm-hmm.
I would much rather sit in my den watching television all day than be outside playing with friends, which I don't know how much of that is me just being lazy.
Right.
I love stories, and I watch such a variety of things as an, you know, 5, 6, 7 year old, because I was watching all the reruns of I Love Lucy and Happy Days and some other shows that were on Nick at Night
every
evening. And so I got really kind of intense exposure to those sitcoms, and then was also watching, obviously, Nickelodeon all day long, but was also watching things like MASH and ER. I loved as a second grader. It was on Thursdays at 10 o'clock at night, and I used to try so hard to keep my eyes open and not fall asleep so that I could stay up and watch George Clooney on ER. A couple different things that, like, I knew I shouldn't really be watching, but I appreciated it. Like, I was allowed to stay up and watch it because I think my parents understood that I just enjoyed the storytelling. Mm-hmm. I was always a writer, always making my cousins in the neighborhood kids put on plays and doing all that kind of stuff, as so many different people do, I know.
Right.
I was always in dance. I love tap dancing. I love just all different kinds of storytelling. When we would go on vacations as a kid, I would always write in my journal every day what had happened. We recently found one from when I was six, and the spelling is just hilarious. But I always, always, always loved telling stories, writing stories, and really loved TV. I never thought that I could work in TV. Mm-hmm. That was something famous people did, and it was impossible to try to be able to do that. And I hated reading as a younger kid, and then grew to appreciate it more in middle school and high school, and thought maybe there's something, you know, this is the way I need to go. Cause mm-hmm. you know, TV and filmmaking isn't safe. Like that's right. not a safe career. Maybe I need to focus more on, you know, literary analysis. And I was, you know, I got to a place where I could churn out a research paper in mm-hmm. a short amount of time. You know, I was an English major in undergrad, and rhetoric and you know, just a lot of analysis of literature and teaching literature
right.
became more of my initial path, because it seemed, I don't know, I definitely was interested in it. I wanted to be influential. I wanted to get other people excited about stories. And I thought, okay, well, teaching is, you know, the other way to go here. Mm-hmm. That's what I initially did. I taught high school for 7 years.
Wow. Yeah.
Before I moved out to Los Angeles. And that change happened for a couple dozen different reasons. but I was looking for ways to be able to love stories, get other people to love stories, be able to write, be able to try to get other people to love writing and reading, and be able to facilitate conversations about stories, really. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that television was an option.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, yeah. you know, pursue that intensely. I didn't take screenwriting classes in undergrad or try to get involved at the high school level in any of that. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that that was possible.
Yeah. What subject did you say, what subject you taught in high school?
Mostly 10th grade English. I think I taught a 10th grade English course. I was in North Carolina. Something like 28 times in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would have three of the same class every day. So I would repeat the same thing three times every day.
Right.
I also ran the school newspaper for 5 or 6 years and grew to really love that. And it was fun because I got to keep those kids for, you know, 2 or 3 years in a row. And mm-hmm. so that was really, really nice. But the repetitiveness of it, it does, you know, it takes a toll.
Yeah.
On you when something's that repetitive and you think, oh, I have 30 more years of this, you know, potentially of doing right. the same thing. And there wasn't a whole lot of room to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't really want to be a principal. I saw what, I mean, I had some great principals and some not so great, you know, administration staff, assistant principals, different roles. And I thought, nope, no thanks.
Mm. Right, right.
I appreciated, you know, what they did when we had great people in those roles, but that wasn't for me. And aside from that, it was either, you know, writing curriculum, which sort of removes you from why you signed up for this in the first place, or just, right. you know, there wasn't a whole lot of room for growth. And then I was in North Carolina. It was very obvious and very, very clear that they didn't value, you know, us in terms of salary. They were cutting, they continuing to cut salaries every time, you know, as I was there and not really coming back. And I'm going on a whole tangent now, but every teacher has 2 or 3 jobs because they don't pay people enough. And one of my jobs was starting to write blog posts and you know, entertainment articles about television.
Yeah.
Because I said, you know, I never stopped loving television. I never stopped being obsessed with shows that I just found to be so either entertaining or just was mind blown by the craft of the writing. And, mm-hmm. and I always used to think, like, I wonder who sat around a table and came up with that.
Right.
Even as a kid coming out of a movie or coming, you know, or finishing an episode of a TV show, I would be like, who sat down and said, let's do this. Like, I wanted to watch that conversation happen.
Mm.
And I knew that from a young age. And then I found myself, you know, then things like Twitter happened, and all of a sudden I could live tweet as I'm watching TV along with the people in the TV show and the writer. And I was like, wait, like, this is awesome. And that's how I started being able to see more of like that fandom blog culture that was happening. And I got involved in that and was able to make a bit of money on the side and do some part-time work, but also it led to being able to attend Comic-Con and seeing, oh, you know, this is the staff writer for this show, and talking with that person and being like, you know, I was still very impressed with them and knew that they were incredibly talented and had worked, you know, for years and years, like beyond what I had, you know, done. But I was like, maybe I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was starting, like the path was becoming more real, like more tangible. It wasn't this like mystery scenario to get a job like this. And after a few years of sort of networking while I was still teaching and sort of building contacts and learning more about how working in television actually works, even though I still knew so little about it, I felt confident enough to make the jump.
Mm-hmm. And so I know now you're doing work at Vice, correct?
So I just wrapped a pilot, actually. And so I'm not able to say at the moment, like, if that will continue to have a future. It very well may not. But yes, I just wrapped a pilot that I've been working on since November that was the first time I was able to actually like venture out into the field and interview survivors of a group that many people call a cult. And it was the first time I've worked on, you know, many series now in post-production, a few in the researching stages and sort of helping. I've worked on several season one shows, which has been a unique experience because I've spent a lot more time than I think other people have who've done this for the same amount of time on shows that are just starting out. Well, what does the show look like? What does the music sound like? What does the font of the slate look like? What does, you know, establishing that format? It's such a huge job. And I've been able to sort of, you know, be part of that experience now on a few different shows and seeing what goes into something like that. And on this, it was even a step further because I was, you know, part of this producing team when I wasn't part of the team when they sold this idea, when they sold the pitch. But when that happened, they didn't quite know what the first episode looked like yet. It hadn't been cast. They hadn't decided which group they were going to focus on. And so I was part of that team when that decision was made about, okay, these are the people that are actually going to be in the pilot. This is where we're going to film. This is the story we're looking to tell and what, you know, kinds of methods of control this group is using and how we're going to try and help and actually, you know, do something purposeful here for real people. And I always try to find shows where, you know, sometimes it's just pure entertainment, but some of the series I work on are more about, you know, how are we helping someone? What is this? You know, what purpose is this serving someone? And so from that stage, once we knew what this pilot was going to be about, you know, I didn't do the bulk of the writing on this particular episode, but I was there as we were, you know, drafting an outline and figuring out our shooting schedule and figuring out, you know, how we only had 6 days to shoot.
Wow.
The 12-hour days. And so we needed to make sure that every scene, you know, every hour of the day was being used efficiently, and that when we got into post that we couldn't do reshoots. So we needed to make sure that we had everything we needed. And so we flew out, we filmed in Indiana and two different cities in Ohio. And that was new to me. We were very small. We were only six people plus the two hosts of the show. It was a very small crew. We were all doing, you know, two or three different jobs. It was the first time that I was interviewing talent in the field. And really, you know, in that moment saying, okay, like, what else do we need? Like, what happened to this conversation? What didn't happen? What else do we need to service this story?
Right.
And in real time, you know, reading our outlines and thinking about servicing the story and listening to this real vulnerable, emotional conversation and having to take a step back and be like, you know, okay, what parts of this didn't we get? What, you know, is this going on a tangent? Is I've never had to be in a situation. I've done it in post where I say, mm-hmm. you know, how come we don't have this, or why don't, you know, we need this, or it would be great if we could, you know, the scene in this direction. But, you know, knowing you have, you know, 2 minutes to decide whether or not you need to get, you know, different questions asked, or if you want to touch on something different that hasn't been brought up organically. That was all very new. It was very, you know, on the spot. And then, you know, after working in the field, after we wrapped in the field, we had like 24 hours, and then we immediately started in post stringing out scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And we turned in that rough cut last week. So it was a whirlwind of a few months, and it was a really great experience, because I got to, you know, sort of be involved and observe and participate in each sort of step of this process, and watching this, you know, thing that started as a couple of index cards on a board, or started as an email, turning into like a really excellent rough cut of a full pilot that served purpose, that had meaning, that was, mm-hmm. you know, that is looking to truly help people and expose something that needs to stop. And we were so, so grateful for the people who came forward and spoke with us and, you know, opened up to us, and you know, we tried to do our best to share their story in the best way we could, you know?
So it's essentially, it's a documentary, a pilot for a documentary, like a documentary series.
It's a pilot for a documentary series. So each episode, my understanding is that each episode mm-hmm. will, you know, focus on a different group.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So what were, share what you can, what were some of the challenges of telling the stories of the people coming out of this group? And how did you overcome them?
That's a really good question. Some of it was just access.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were only able to talk to the people that wanted to talk to us. We were only able to talk to the people who fit in the schedule for when we were going to be there, and, mm-hmm. and who knew who, and who was willing to share with us. This story was so big.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest challenges is story producing it in a way so that you have a clear journey for the active investigation, but mm-hmm. still letting that happen organically.
Yeah.
Because when you're studying a group that's hurt so many people, or is, you know, has some people have called a cult, or mm-hmm. is known for having some methods of control and manipulation over people, these stories are so personal and so can be so individual, and trying to, you know, if there are a couple of dozen different things that we would love to expose, really trying to choose, okay, which things do we want to focus on that will tell the best story and also serve these survivors the best and help expose this group in the best way possible? Like, mm-hmm. what's the strongest case? And then how do you arrange these different interviews with the people who have come forward so that it feels as though we are learning something new about the group in each stage of the episode, but also feeling like we're part of this active investigation. For each time we learn something new, it helps us connect to the next new piece that we're learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you were to Google something, you might get hit with all this information all at once.
Right.
Or it might not come to you in a sequence that serves the story the best.
Mm-hmm.
Those puzzle pieces might come to you in a completely different, you know, different way. And so obviously we are not telling anyone, you know, what to say, what to do, like that, you know, this is not scripted. This is real.
Right.
This is an active investigation. It's organic storytelling, but making sure that the hosts of the show, like the people who were interviewing these people, also were, we went back and forth, like, do we want them to know everything? Do we want them to learn things in real time? I think the biggest challenge was, like, how do we arrange everything? I don't know if that's the right word, but like, how do we structure this so that everyone is on this journey with us and everyone's on the same page? And yet it's still, like, I don't know if exciting is the right word, but we're learning new pieces of information in a way that makes us feel like, you know, at each minute we're realizing just how controlling it is, or just how much this group needs to be taken down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was something that was truly difficult. And it's hard because you don't ever want to cut or not have time for something that someone has been so vulnerable with you about, and having to take a 3-hour interview and only choose 3 or 4 minutes of that to show will always be what I say, no matter what the show is, no matter what topic it is, whether it's a motivational show or, you know, an active investigation or a biopic, like whatever it is, like that will always be when someone is so vulnerable with you and giving you their time and opens up to you and you're not able to show the entire thing, like, and having to make those decisions about which pieces of this story do we have time for, which pieces of it make the best story, have the greatest impact, service this pilot as a whole in the best way possible, while also doing justice to this person's real personal life experience that hurt them for over a decade. I wrestled with that a little bit as I was stringing, because I, you know, I don't know. I would love to talk to other story producers about this too, because it's such a, you're not writing the script before you film, right? Mm-hmm. You're writing the, you know, air quotes script. You're not really writing a script ever, but you're putting this, if someone was to transcribe the pilot, right, you're doing that after you've filmed.
Right.
And so I've worked on shows where, you know, I worked on a really popular treasure hunting show where we would look at 10 hours of treasure hunting footage from the day and decide, okay, which moments are the best. And that's very, very different because, you know, obviously it's when they find something in the ground that is exciting. And when, you know, but with this, it's like every moment was powerful and emotional. And you know, these people gave their time to us and went back into difficult places in their lives to open up and tell us these stories. And yet having to fit 6 whole days worth of filming into 44 minutes. I mean, that's the part that I think I found to be challenging, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. And so your role in this was story producer?
Yeah, I was an associate story producer, or I guess really an associate producer, but we didn't have a story producer. And so, like I said, a lot of us took on different roles. I officially came in as an associate producer, and then it was just me and the showrunner in the field.
Right.
We didn't have a field producer. We didn't have a story producer. So both of us were kind of taking on those roles as well.
All right. We're going to take a break from the podcast so that we can pay some bills. Tired of uploading content to multiple systems? Now you can work smarter, not harder, with Sony's C Media Cloud. Get blazing fast uploads, secure, reliable backup, seamless, simple sharing, and real-time collaboration in a single, easy-to-use cloud service. With C, the possibilities are virtually endless. C allows your team to securely and reliably share, organize, review, and collaborate on, and deliver professional media files all in a flash. You'll find C's powerful built-in collaboration tools and apps are designed specifically for media professionals to work more efficiently. And C's creative suite of apps and tools can empower broadcast and production teams to collaborate on videos in real time, all within a trusted workspace. Let Sony's C Media Cloud help transform how your content moves across the entire media cycle, from camera to post to final cut, faster. Learn more about C and book your free demo at sonymcs.com. That's Sony, M as in Mary, C as in Charlie, S as in Sam.com. Now, back to the podcast. Describe, if you will, the typical role of a story producer.
Yes. So a story producer is someone who works in nonfiction and reality television, who sometimes works in the field, like during filming, but mostly my experience is that this person works in post-production. And you are crafting and shaping the story after the scenes have been filmed.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, anything from like a Bravo Real Housewives type series to a very serious documentary, you know, you're taking everything that's been shot and you are watching through all of it. You have to understand every detail about the footage that you have. all of the interviews that have been done, all of the OTFs, the on-the-fly interviews in the scene that mm-hmm. have been done. And you have to have the best understanding of everything that you have at your disposal to then start breaking down scenes. And what you're really doing is helping the editor shape the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so what a lot of times what story producers do, we do what's called string outs.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're taking a scene and you are doing like a radio edit of it. Like mm-hmm. you're choosing which dialogue to include, what to cut, and you're getting a scene that's maybe an hour down to 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would pass that on to the editor who is going to make it look beautiful.
Right.
At least
right.
for me, I'm not good at the visuals and I can't make it look fancy. So that's what the editor will do. And it's a very collaborative job. It's an extremely collaborative job. You're working with your showrunner, you're working with a supervising producer, you're working with other story producers, you're working with editors, you're working with associate producers to shape your episode and get it ready for, sometimes you have an outline. A lot of times you have, you know, extensive field notes so that you can understand what happened during filming.
Mm-hmm.
And you, based on what the intention of the episode is, you create that episode with the footage that you have. It's like putting a giant puzzle together, or it's like writing a script with right. a giant word bank, you know, like, and then as notes come in, I mean, you're the person who is addressing notes. So as you get studio notes or internal notes or network notes, you're the person who is, you know, going back because of your knowledge of the footage. And if something needs to be changed or corrected, or they want a different emotion in a certain place, you're the person that needs to make those changes happen.
Mm.
I do not like to work on shows where we are heightening an emotion that wasn't really there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure that people know that on some reality TV shows, there are moments where a fight looks bigger than it really was or something like that.
Right.
I don't have much experience working on things like that. I don't think I'd be interested so much in that. I'm more interested in shows that either have like a history side to them or an educational aspect or are helping people. I worked on a show for Disney Plus where we had families who had adopted pets during the pandemic.
Mm, wow.
Dogs, adopted dogs during the pandemic. And now that they were starting to go back to work, they found themselves to be in a really challenging situation where they didn't actually know how to be separated, or the dog didn't know how to be separated from them. They didn't know how to be separated from the dog. They didn't actually understand
right.
how to train a dog. And a lot of these families were at their last days of maybe considering having to give the dog back or considering having to rehome the dog. And so this show was able to sort of put these families through training to be able to, you know, create really positive relationships with their family dogs and behavior that was causing them to want to rehome the dog. And so I found that to be really fulfilling too, because we were, you know, anything where we're helping mm-hmm. people or helping families. And so I gravitate more towards shows like that. I did just do Dancing with the Stars this past season, though.
Oh, did you really?
I did. You're a story producer. I grew up dancing. I love watching it. I actually reached out and asked. Like that's how I got the job. I was like, I found the names of the people in the credits from last season who were right. in the department I wanted to be in. I found them in a Facebook group that I was also part of. We were all part of the same group. I didn't just, you know, I made sure we had a connection somewhere.
Right.
And I asked. I said, hey, I think you guys are hiring. I'd love to, you know, be part of this team. And I got a yes. So that was pretty crazy.
What was that experience like?
Wild experience. It was really cool. It was just many, many more hours than I expected it to be. I've never been on a show where you get footage on a Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say footage, I'm talking about, I just want to be really clear. I was working on the rehearsal montages.
Mm-hmm.
So when, you know, the minute or so, the time was a little bit different each week, but the minute or so before a couple takes the stage, you see a package of what right. their previous week has looked like, or like yeah. a flashback to the prior week. So that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Similar to So You Think You Can Dance was like that.
Yeah. 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 So we would get those interviews on it, and the scene where the person found out what their new dance and their new song was going to be, that would be filmed usually on the Tuesday after the show.
Mm-hmm.
And we would get that footage into the system either Tuesday night or Wednesday morning. and it would be due Thursday or Friday.
Wow.
And so it was a really quick turnaround, and we're watching rehearsals as this happens. So if something happens in rehearsal on Friday that's really impactful or really emotional, or someone, you know, unfortunately gets hurt, or, you know, something happens that you're not expecting, the entire package might need to change.
Right.
Because of that. And so we were remote. They had cameras like live streaming rehearsal, and we could log in and watch the live stream of the rehearsal. And so that's how we kind of kept track of what was happening in real time. We also did get some, you know, some field notes, and those guys were great and stuff, but we were really sitting there watching at all times what was happening in the rehearsal room for our couples. We had a couple different teams, and we each had, you know, three or four couples, and then sometimes shifted based on who was still in the show and things to even it out. But no, that turnaround time was pretty crazy. And then we would get, you know, it would be several different rounds of notes. So we would have notes sometimes Thursday night, and then Friday night and Saturday night. And then we, the first half of Sunday is when they would lock, because they were live the following day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been, you know, used to working on shows where you had several months to get a lock cut of an episode out. We're talking, and that would be a 40 minute, you know, we were talking about sometimes these things were 50 seconds. Sometimes they were up to maybe 2 minutes, maybe 1 week or two, it was above 2 minutes, but it doesn't seem like a lot of work, but it was really intense. In a good way, in a good way. I really enjoyed that experience, but it was just a lot of hours. And you've got, you know, when you have 15 couples, that's 15 packages. Or when we had a week where we had two shows, like one show Monday, one show Tuesday, and there were 12 couples maybe. So that's what, you know, 24 packages for one team to be reviewing and giving notes on. It just, it's just time consuming. Everyone was super nice.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really positive group. Like the supervising stroke producer I worked with was, she was just amazing at what she did. And the executive producers were all like just super lovely. Like it was a really great team. I enjoyed working with everyone so much.
Right.
I was taken aback a little bit at everything that went into it. It was such a great learning experience. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But it's kind of wild to think about like how quickly that turnaround is for live shows.
Yeah, no, I bet. Earlier you were talking about the shrinkouts you were doing for the show that you were working on currently. And is there a director that you're working with? Someone else who's collaborating with you who like is the final creative voice for the project? Because like if you're making the string out, that was the showrunner. Okay.
So he and I, because we didn't have, usually, you know, you'd have a showrunner or a co-executive producer overseeing posts. And then within that, you'd have several teams typically of story producers and associate producers. But on this, because it was just the pilot, it was just he and I.
Mm-hmm.
And so we split the episode. Like when we first started doing strings, just the two of us, before editors even came on, we just alternated scenes and each took scenes, and I would get them down as far as I could. And then I'd pass them off to him, and then he would be able to put his, you know, like finishing thoughts on it and be able to cut additional, you know, moments that he felt were extra or weren't needed to service the story.
Right.
I also did a ton of archive. That's a big part of the job as well. You know, finding, photos and video clips to be able to use as coverage on top of what's being said. And so if someone's talking about what happened in Waco and we want to be able to show footage, news footage of that as this discussion is happening, being able to go find that footage, be able to, you know, make sure that it's approved to use, figuring out if it's within our budget to be able to use it and getting it ingested into the system. And that every production company has a slightly different process for how that works, but archive is also a big part of the job as well.
How does that process work? Like when you're using news footage and, you know, to what extent, like does fair use cover any of the footage that you use, or do you have to pay for it all? And where do
sometimes,
you find it?
I've worked on 7 or 8 shows that have used archive, and every show is different.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on the legal team, the rights and clearances team that work for that company. I've worked on shows that have very specific, you know, you're using this website, it's going to cost, you know, everything on this website is $95. We have an agreement with them and you're allowed to spend up to this much and you need to keep track as you're going to make sure you haven't hit that budget. And, you know, in that role with some companies, if you're using, like, let's say you're writing, if you're producing a pilot about a group and that group has a website that's public.
Right.
And they've put videos on their own website that are public.
Mm-hmm.
Some production companies or studios may let you use that under fair use if it's a certain amount of time. Like, let's say it has to be less than 10 seconds at a time or less than 20 seconds at a time or 3 seconds. Or throughout the episode, the times can't add up to be more than 15 seconds. Some places have, you know, will have specific rules like that. Other places won't let you use it at all. It just depends on what that team's perspective is, and the rules at One Network can be very, very different, like from show to show.
Right.
And I personally always make sure, like, that's one of the first things I do now is like really ask to speak with whoever that legal person is or the rights and clearances person to get a full understanding of what we can and cannot do. Mm-hmm. Because when editors or other story producers or executive producers are saying, oh, let's get this, let's get footage of that, let's find photos of this, sometimes you're able to, you know, go ahead and put those in knowing that you might not be able to use them in the end, but you just kind of want to see what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And other times you're not even able to bring them into the system to even see what they look like unless they've been cleared and approved, because they don't want to accidentally, you know, or even just think that you might be able to use this and get too excited about it. Right. And so every team is different.
Yeah.
Every team is different. Every, you know, process is different. Everyone's going to have the way they prefer to do things. These people know way, way more than I do about legal repercussions if something makes it to air that should not have. And we definitely don't want anyone to be in that kind of situation. So to be careful with that stuff. But yeah, news footage specifically is interesting because if it's not on one of those, you know, stock websites, you do need to go seek out who has the rights and ask them.
Mm-hmm.
Or and then what they'll do is they'll give you like a screener clip of it to use.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they charge you for that. Sometimes they don't. And then based on, you know, every conversation is different. It's really case by case. It's, you know, what's the purpose of the footage? You know, is it being used in a way that only services the story and doesn't, you know, you're not framing this company in a poor light. Or, you know, how many seconds do you want to use? Do you want to use audio? Is the news person, like the newscaster's voice, a separate, like, do you need to clear with that person's team that you're able to use their voice? So it could be very simple and it could be very difficult. And it just depends on whatever that company is policies are, really.
Yeah.
It can become really time consuming. It can become really a whole journey to try and get a news clip into a show, for sure.
Yeah. And that's something that often falls under the role of the story producer. Or does that vary as well?
It depends. I know that's my answer for a lot of things. I've been on shows where it very much is the story producer's job. And some of those shows, I wasn't expecting that. And I've been on shows where the story team has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's a show where we're not using archive as much as we're building graphics or we're building animation, you know, like on the treasure hunting show, we used some archive, but because it was like season 7, it was repeated photos that had been used in prior seasons. And so a lot of that had already been cleared. And so we didn't really have to touch any of that. The editors knew what they were and weren't able to include in the episodes, but we would support the graphics building team. And so our story producing team would, you know, if the narrator was explaining how a certain tunnel was able to connect to a drain system that then, you know, filtered water through XYZ places, and we were trying to get that visual on the screen, I would have to either, you know, write out what we wanted the graphic to look like, or if we were talking about, like, I would need to go find the B-roll of what they found and put some like little package together of examples of what we wanted this graphic to look like.
Right.
And then we'd pass that on to the graphics team and the effects team, and they would animate based on our B-roll and based on our thoughts, what we wanted to cover, what the narrator was saying. And so on that, I've never done that on a different show, but on that show, story producing also meant, you know, getting the graphics team what they needed. And so each genre of, you know, an unscripted show, each network's going to have a different thing. Every format and style is going to be different. And so Yeah, no, on every show I've been on, it's a little bit different about what your role is and what your responsibilities are and what you're lending a hand in based on that show's needs.
Yeah. As we get nearer to the end of our time, I wanted to make sure I ask you, is there like a path that a person might take if they're interested in being a story producer and doing the kind of work that you do?
Yeah, I started...
Is it getting on Facebook and like stalking the shows you want to work
at? It's a lot of networking. Story producers, like I said, some story producers do work in the field. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're just called field producers. Mm-hmm. But those would be the people, if you're more interested in being on set and actually, you know, making sure that the scene happens in the way that you want it, or, you know, are encouraging it to happen, or you're, you know, giving that direction for what the scene should be, that would be a field producer. And you would start by being a field associate producer or someone who is taking field notes.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, you would work as a PA, a field PA. You have to be very good at typing quickly, very mm-hmm. good at keeping up with story and understand as you're constantly typing everything that's being said with time codes, understanding what are we missing? What do we still need? You know, and having mm-hmm. that very active awareness of what's going on. On the post-production side, if you want to be that person who is taking all of that footage and putting it together and shaping the episode,
mm-hmm.
again, you would probably want to work as a PA at a post house or for a company in their post, you know, that has post-production going on.
Right, right.
So like when I was on that treasure hunting show for the History Channel, like we had office PAs that were working just for the story producer and the editors.
Right.
And so I would look for a role like that. You want to spend a lot of time with the APs when you have any downtime, sit, learn, watch. You can also learn Avid or Adobe Premiere. Mm-hmm. Most shows I've been on use Avid. Some job postings I've seen are for Adobe Premiere. Mm-hmm. I did not know how to use Avid. It was a whole, talk about a learning experience.
Yeah.
I was thrown into it. I got a 20-minute crash course from the AE who just sort of sat with his head in his hands because he didn't really. He was kind of like just in disbelief that I didn't even know how to, you know, watch down anything at that point. And it took me the year to really feel confident building strings and selecting audio tracks. I mean, it's a lot to learn. Once you get the hang of it, it makes sense, but it's a lot to learn. So definitely spend time learning Avid or Premiere or both. And then from that PA track, you would come up to be an AP. You might be a logger. There are roles that are in between where you're transcribing. Well, again, a lot of typing quickly, a lot of transcribing. And then from there, moving into more of an AP role where you're hands-on with story and doing what's called pulling selects
mm-hmm.
or a wide variety of things. It could be more archival. It could be more research. And then from there, you know, after you've got several credits or a few years of working as an AP, moving up into like a story editor position or, mm-hmm. which is also a title on the scripted side. So it's a little... very
right.
different. And then from there being a story producer, from there people move up to be supervising story producers and sort of overseeing all the teams
mm-hmm.
that are story producing. Because a lot of times what'll happen is like you've got 20 episodes of a series.
Right.
You've got three or four story producing teams and you're rotating. So that team has episode one, the other team has two, the other team has three. And then the team that had episode one gets episode four.
Mm.
And so someone is, you know, starting to pull selects and watch down scenes for the first time and shape an episode as someone else is in the middle of rough cut, as someone else is in the middle of addressing notes to lock.
Right.
And so you, everyone's sort of in a different stage and you rotate throughout the season. And so that a supervising story producer would oversee and make sure all those teams are doing okay. And then from there you'd have a co-EP maybe that's overseeing on top of that. And every show's a little bit different.
Yeah.
But getting in a PA or an AP role that's under the specific track that you're interested in, I would say is the best. And there's something to be said for having experience in both places, because if you've worked in post, you're going to be a better producer in the field
mm-hmm.
because you know what you've been missing in the past. You know what you need. There's something to be said for it vice versa as well. If you're a field producer, you're going to have more of an understanding in post of why something was done a certain way or,
right.
you know, and having, you know, I think there's great benefits for working in both roles or getting some experience, dipping your toes a little bit in both sides of it, because you're going to understand why the other side needs something a certain way or chose to do something a certain way. And that can only improve your work.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's fascinating. And it sounds like I think the most important thing we've learned today, Marissa, is that all these shows need to switch to Final Cut Pro. I just want to anger all of my listeners out there because we have a lot of Avnet users, I'm sure.
Oh, okay.
But one last quick question. Do you have a guilty pleasure that you are watching right now? Or what's your favorite guilty pleasure, movie or television show?
Ooh, that's really hard. If I need to just have something on in the background, probably New Girl or Parks and Rec.
I don't think those count as guilty pleasures. They're so good. They're so good.
You're right. If you had said
Bridgerton or if you said...
I did enjoy that. You know, I did just watch... I got
High School really Musical. I know you like musicals. If you said High School Musical, that would qualify.
I got into like dating reality TV during COVID.
I just finished
Too Hot to Handle. I love The Circle. Which is also a really good show.
Watching The Circle is kind of like watching an accident. Like... It's one of those things that's it's so odd and weird, and I don't know what to make of it. But I remember complaining to my girlfriend because she was watching it consistently, she and her daughter. And I was like, why are you guys watching this show? It's so... And then I found myself watching it, like, it's when good. They went around.
I used to not watch a whole lot of that kind of genre of reality TV, and I found myself during COVID, like, becoming really invested. Below Deck. I got really into Below Deck. I was more fascinated by them physically, like, running the ship than I was about the drama. Like, I was fast-forwarding through the drama because I was just excited to see, like, the nautical side of everything. Yeah.
Interesting.
I was that person.
Yeah. Well, those are good answers. Good answers. And no shade to anyone out there who either works on or likes Bridgerton. I'm sure it's a great show. I mean, it's Shonda Rhimes. What doesn't she do?
I loved it. I've never burned through so many episodes, something like that, in my life. I loved it. Yeah.
Marissa, this was great. I really appreciate the time and you coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you for reaching out.
A huge thanks to Marissa for joining me on the show. You can find additional links and resources, including her website and samples of work, on the show notes for this episode or on the blog post for this episode at provideocoalition.com. Crossing the 180 is a production of Blade Runner Media and part of the Pro Video Coalition's Art of the Frame podcast series. This episode was produced, written, and hosted by yours truly, Ron Dawson. Editing and mixing was done by Maria Passingham. You can follow me on Twitter at Blade Runner, that's Runner with an O, and you can follow me on Instagram at Blurred Runner. And you can follow Pro Video Coalition on Twitter at simply Pro Video. That's it for now. Until next time, remember, if the story sucks, I don't care what you shot it with or cut it on. See ya in 2 weeks.